a very long thank you note in Thai. Very sweet. Thank you for all your thoughtful and pragmatic meditation tips. Do you have advice regarding the future-oriented mind? Speculation, planning, considering, obsessing, really, about scenarios. Normal ideas are not working. Well, I think one of the, and especially when one is recognizing that I'm obsessing about the future, the mind on a certain level, the the way that, you know, how it manifests is not so important as the underlying root of it. So then, it's restlessness. It's restless. It's restlessness looking for an object. Using something that helps to quite directly quell the restlessness. So something like really using a breathing that expands a sense of relaxation and softness and steadiness into the body. Of course, then that affects the mind. Usually, if we just go to the mind, try to control the mind, try to tell the mind to shut up, it really doesn't going to listen. Using the body as a means of relaxing and settling, and it tends to quell that restless energy in the mind. If one wants to use a mental object, then using something that taking the mind and then dwelling on and directing the attention to loving kindness, and that's that quality of very consciously developing the meditations on loving kindness, of well wishing, and that similarly has the effect of softening and quelling the mind and relaxing the whole system. So those are just a couple ideas, but that's, I think, the main thing is that sense of coming a step back and seeing what's pushing the mind out. I love clues that help identify that some experience is or is not what I thought it is. For example, Ajahn Yaniko's point that just a blank, purely absorbed state is not jhana, a wrong conclusion anybody may get to, and that instead it should be more quote-unquote broad-based, and metta bhavana is very useful for that. This sort of test for the labels we may jump to apply to our experience is very useful insight. Cool, if I may say. Are there more such tests? P.S. This is to help prevent my mind from becoming too proud or thinking I've attained some state when not. Yeah, I mean, that's... there's a quote that comes up in the suttas over and over, many different places. For however one may conceive it, it is always other than that. That's a great quote to remind the mind, because we're constantly conceiving in some way, shape, or form, you know, getting excited about something, getting frustrated by something, and for however one can conceive it, it's always going to be other than that. And so that reminding of ourselves. Also, the reflections on and investigations around dukkha, in the sense that dukkha isn't just when you're sort of on the edge of the spectrum of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, and it's more just any of the dis-ease, any of the not quite satisfied, not quite sure. So then those are indications. Those are ways of testing one's assumptions and the ways that we tend to interpret our experience. So that paying attention to the underlying dis-ease, the underlying feeling of not quite satisfied. Just like at tea time, we were talking about Ajahn Yaniko's example of the Japanese sharpener of samurai swords, and how he's been doing it for 40, 50, 60 years or something, and is asked if he ever, was he ever felt satisfied and happy with a sword that he had sharpened, and a sort of, it took a, yeah, I think there was one time that I felt. There is that sense of when the mind can't quite get satisfied. That's a good indication that we need to work around that or work with it. Thank you for talking about the nun who got enlightened the other day. Also thanks to Debbie for her talk. As a female myself, I find it inspirational hearing stories about women on the path. Most teachers, well-known disciples, the Buddha himself, were males, so at times I struggled to connect to the teachings. It felt too mind-focused, too quote-unquote male, as more women in my view connect through the heart, or at least I do. I see a lot of heart and compassion in the Dhamma now, and I'm learning more about women in Buddhism. It would be great to hear more stories about them in Dhamma talks, and perhaps one day even have a guest nun visit and give a talk. So, I mean, there are nuns living and practicing in the Bay Area, so that those can be there's one place in Sonoma County here, out by Jenner, and then also Placerville. Yeah, in Placerville, and there are nuns living, practicing, teaching here.
They'll be doing a retreat here.
Is it here? Yeah.
It's at Gills.
Okay, that's over the New Year. Yeah. Okay. The guidance through seeing the non-self in relationship to the elements was very helpful. Can you explain what to look for in order to see the non-self in relationship to strong emotions like grief? When do you look for the emptiness in emotions, and when do you experience or express them? How does one balance the two? I think with it, you know, in terms of emotions, say like grief, a lot of it, it's not really a choice, oftentimes, in the sense that it's just learning to understand how grief manifests, learning how to understand how particular emotions manifest and what they feel like and what their kind of cycle is, and taking an interest in them, not in the sense of being overwhelmed and being identifying with them, but it's more like, oh yeah, here, this is grief. This is what grief feels like. This is what anger feels like. So rather than, you know, I have to act on this anger, or I have to, and especially something like grief, then, you know, that's going to come in waves. And one starts to look at the how does it come? How does it arise? What happens? What's it feel like in the body? What's it feel like in the mind? How to work with it? And also, you know, giving oneself the option of what is it like to not experience? I've certainly found through my own practice, and that being really open to the feelings that arise, then it tends to, it doesn't seem to arise in the same way. When Ajahn Chah died, he was my teacher. I had the utmost respect and really gave my life to him, and he's died. What do I feel? Is there grief? I think I'd done my grieving before, as he became ill, and we looked after him, and then I found that I didn't. There wasn't grief there. It was gratitude. There was incredible devotion and respect, but it's out of my control. It didn't come up, and it was kind of similar when my father passed away. I remember when I was told that my father passed away, I was in retreat, and people came to tell me, and then arranged for me to go back. I was in Thailand to be able to go back into sort of catching a plane and start making the moves to head back. And they sat and chattered and talked and wouldn't go away. And I was patient and engaging but there was this inner feeling of, no, I just want to sit quietly with this. I don't want to talk to anybody. And then when they left, then I went into my kuti and I did that lit candles and incense and did a puja and just to be able to sit quietly and allow to sink in and whatever grief to come up, to allow it to come up. And then I waited and watched my breath and I kept waiting and waiting. And it never came. And I said, well, maybe it didn't come today, maybe it'll be another day. So then I kept looking and sort of, okay, allowing, just keeping, holding it as open as possible. It never really manifested. And I was very close to my father. I'm close to both my parents, close to my family. I think a lot of it is when we see that quality of non-self, both in the body and the mind, our emotions, or the world we live in. There is an emptiness there, and it can be seen and experienced, and there's appropriate times to if something's coming up, then one shouldn't be trying to suppress it, trying to push it away, trying to label it as something else, or trying to. But I think it's important that we really do our sort of like our due diligence with our emotions in the presence, and to really contemplate our own relationship to our own body, our own feelings, the world around us, our closest family members and loved ones, and then really be honest with what one's experiencing. Really be ready to work with it skillfully. Probably the closest person to me now is my mother. And I'd have no idea what I'll feel like when my mother passes away. I mean, she's 91 going on 92. She doesn't look like she's slowing down yet. who knows how I'll feel, and I think it's just really keeping things really open for possibilities, but also that sense of really dealing with it, really being honest with whatever's coming up, and keep it open so that one is really dealing with this as much as possible in the present. How is compassion different from loving kindness? Karuna and being compassion, metta being loving kindness. Is compassion similar to empathy? I'm also wondering if it means you feel the pain of the person you feel compassion for. The explanations of difference around the kind of focus or intention in the mind for loving kindness is the wish for the happiness and well-being of others. And compassion is the wish to alleviate their suffering. And so they're you know, it's obviously related, but slightly different. Slightly different flavor. Compassion is similar to empathy in the sense that it tunes into the suffering, recognizes the suffering that others experience. But there's a point where another word in Buddhist terminology that is also translated and used as the word compassion is anukampa, and it means to tremble with. And it means that trembling with, in the sense, the heart resonates and trembles with the feelings of others. So that there's that empathy is there. And for those, when we do the request for the Dhamma talks, is anukampi mang pachang. And so it's like out of compassion, requesting the Dhamma talk, sort of drawing on the teacher's compassion. So that and the word that's used is anukampa, there's compassion. So there is this sense of empathy and literally meaning trembling with. But it's also, there's a point where, the near enemy of compassion is pity. It's like to feel pity for somebody, to feel because it looks kind of similar, and maybe if one is too empathetic, one identifies with, and then it becomes, rather than it being a catalyst for compassion, it becomes an obstruction to compassion, because it overwhelms the mind. Not only does one feel the pain or suffering of others, one overwhelms one's own mind with suffering, and then is unable to access that quality of alleviation, because one has overwhelmed one's own heart with suffering. So it's a very, it's a delicate balance. That sense again, tuning in to that sincere wish to want to help, to alleviate, to free others from their suffering. But it's hard to do that work effectively if one is weighing oneself down with that same suffering. So one has to be attentive to that balance. And compassion is not just an intellectual recitation of "may you be free from suffering," so it's not blowing it off because you're so sort of stepped back from it. But there is a balance there that needs to be really paid attention to. there's a question of the Ajñāniko and Venkatapo, why be a monk?
Ajñāniko and Kasapo. Why to be a monk?
Why be a monk?
Suffering. I think that's a very good answer. To end suffering.
No. To end suffering, yes. Suffering. Not to create suffering. Okay, here, there's a question for all the bhikkhus, and we'll see how that just went over. So, I'll do my best on this. Can you please recall a time when you were intensely attacked by the armies of Mara and had a lot of suffering, and what you did to overcome it? What strategy did you use, or whether nothing worked at all, and you just had to be patient with it and accept it? Thank you for your teaching. That's the story of monastic life. One of the beauties of monastic life that you really resent often is the fact that there is no escape. You're left with a lot of suffering because, when you ordain as a monk your greed, hatred, and delusion all ordain with you, and it's not some kind of magic solution, but the lifestyle is such that you don't really have many distractions, you don't really have many ways of getting out of it. We'd come up with all sorts of strategies. You're quite inventive about how to get out of it. But the Buddha was. I can remember so many times God, the Buddha was incredibly diabolical in this. Because all the avenues of gratification, distraction, all kind of blocked, so that all the different pulls and unskillful habits of the mind are kind of laid bare for you. So then you just have to start experimenting with this, experimenting with that, and some things work. And some things work for a little while, but don't work, cease to work. They arise and they pass away. And then some things you just have to be really patient. And that was so much of what Ajahn Chah used to teach us was. Is learning how to be patient, and that sense of patience really takes on a whole other meaning and a nuance in terms of the patience, not just being something that you you patiently put up with something and waiting for it to be over, but you're patient with something so you can be present with it and really watch it, observe it clearly, and that's. I can remember one time being with another Western monk who, Ajahn Viradamo, and he was having some difficulty and frustration at the time, and Ajahn Chah was. And you're saying, just learn how to be patient. Just do, that's all you need to do. You don't have to understand everything. You don't have to practice everything. Just learn how to be patient with what you've got. And he said, learn how to practice like an earthworm. It's like, earthworms are down in Ajahn Chah is a great actor. And earthworms, they don't see anything. They're just down in the ground. They don't know where they're going. They just got their head down. They're just going. Just learn how to practice like that. Just keep going forward. Just be an earthworm. So that's always been a great, great piece of advice. And really learn, put your head down and just keep going. It feels overwhelming, but just inching along. Okay, thank you so much for your teachings and for answering all our questions with patience and wisdom. Can one contemplate pain using the four elements, or is there a more direct way to penetrate physical pain? Many thanks for your teaching. Actually, the four elements is a really, really good way of contemplating pain, in the sense of because pain it immediately goes to. Forming an image of what's painful, forming a very clear image of the kind of aversion to it or the fear of it. But then taking the four elements and then starting to contemplate the sensation of heat and cold, the fire element. What's happening there? How is that manifesting? What's the actual manifestation of the earth element? What's the sensation around the area that is painful? Is it hard? Is it soft? Is it rough? Is it smooth? Is it heavy? Is it light? What's the quality of the feeling there? And you start going into that, but so get what's the feeling of pressure, in the sense of is it pushing? Is it supporting? What's the pressure? Is it expanding? Is it contracting? What's it doing in terms of the air element? What's it feel like in terms of a sense of fluidity? Was there a flow to it? Is a flow obstructed by it? So then you're looking at it not as my painful knee, which you have visualized anatomically, and then as obviously something anatomically tearing there, and it's going to need to go to a doctor and a hospital and all that. But just really paying attention to that. How does it manifest on that on a very different perspective of these elements. Oftentimes it opens up different possibilities for the experience and allows that the experience of pain. You have to be, with physical pain, you have to be, you have to take an interest in it. You also have to be you can't be too kind of cavalier and gung-ho either, in the sense of inhabiting a physical body is painful. That's a reality. But there's also sometimes when one doesn't look at, sometimes pain is actually trying to tell you something, and you should be looking after yourself in a certain way. There's a lot of the pain that we experience, just inhabiting a physical body. It can be ameliorated and attended to with mindfulness and care, and one can learn a lot from it. I spent a lot of my early years as a monk just contemplating pain. I had lots of illnesses and injuries, I really learned a lot about Dhamma. So not to be, too afraid of pain, but you want to exercise wisdom also, because I've seen monks who are just trying to shut it out and don't want to experience it, and then it exacerbates a condition, and that's not useful. And some who one of our monks who had a burst appendix, and it wasn't until we got him to the hospital because he wasn't complaining. we took him to the hospital. And then it was sort of, oh, wow, that was close. Okay, first, thank you to Ajahn Yaniko for encouraging us to see Dhamma in the hearts of around us and within. And then, apart from our beloved teachers and tradition, where else in our modern world do you see Dhamma in the hearts of those who also in various ways seek the end of suffering for all? Who particularly inspires you? Who is worthy of respect? For example, for me, your support of Julia Butterfly Hill was inspired by courage. Correct. Could a future Buddha be a Sangha? Is it already happening? Okay, your thoughts, Ajahn Paso, and those of your esteemed company, appreciate it. I think oftentimes the Ajahn Yaniko gave some great examples of we tend to look sometimes a bit too far And there's good examples of people living committed, wholesome, skillful lives in the world around us, and to pay attention to that, and also to encourage and support them as well. And I think what the person wrote in terms of the support that we gave to Julia Butterfly Hill was her commitment and care for the environment. But also that, I think in terms of in the world, I think some of the things that inspire me are, that I really think are worthy of respect are like people who are really committed to education. I find that really my own sense of it's really worthy of respect, people who are committed to education, committed to bringing examples to young people. I find that really inspiring. And there's lots of good examples of that out there, and both, say, in the Buddhist world as well as outside of that. And there's lots of other, there's always, I mean, that was sort of the thing, it's like when Ajahn Sumedho was living with Ajahn Chah in the early years, He was one, there weren't any other Westerners showing up for several years. And he was quite happy and content with the fact that he would be the only Westerner living with Ajahn Chah, and he could end up, dying in Thailand, that'd be fine. He didn't really have a plan to be anything or do anything. And after he'd been there for a while, not a long while, Ajahn Chah asked him, "Do you think you'll ever go back to America one day?" And Ajahn Sumedho said, "No, I'll never go back to America." And he went on this rant of couldn't ever live there as a monk, nobody would look after us, nobody has any interest in Buddhism, they're not Buddhists, and going on in that vein. And Ajahn Chah looked at him with a real concern. "You mean to say there's no kind people in America?" And then that was when Ajahn Sumedho realized, oh, okay, right. at some point, he would be going back to the West. I mean, it ended up he spent his time in England, but it was sort of, have to go back to the West at some point, because it's not really about Buddhist teachings, Buddhist dogma, Buddhist card-carrying Buddhist types. It's around the human condition, and it doesn't really matter where you are. There's going to be kind people. There's going to be good people, and they're looking for. They're looking for ways to live their life skillfully, and oftentimes it's just a lack of example and lack of access. That's the problem. Okay. Thank you so much for these wonderful teachings. Sometimes a very intense light nimitta arises, and it feels like all my energy rushes to my forehead. I try to ignore the nimitta, but it gets brighter and undulating. I try to pull it down to my feet, but that doesn't work. I've tried all sorts of things, but ultimately I just stop sitting and start walking. The nimitta gives me a headache and is draining. One, why does it happen? Two, what to do? The number one, why does it happen? I don't know, really. That's kind of irrelevant in the sense that it's happening, okay, what to do? And sometimes it's like that. If it's too intense, then, okay, stopping sitting and walking, that's a viable option as well. I think one of the things with, a nimitta arises, if it's too intense, if it's too, and then one is trying too hard to either pull it down to the feet, ignoring it, not wanting it, then yeah, that sets up a tension. Yeah, it ends up in a headache. To be able to allow especially if with an image of light, one of the things that you want to try to do is, especially in this circumstance, in the sense that it doesn't feel comfortable, then what you want to be doing is trying to making it feel comfortable. And learning how to allow that to that image of light to start to be a presence of ease, and one can do that with, like, especially when one's using the breath in conjunction with that. As you say, it's undulating. You can allow that to undulate with the breath, and then using that to soften and to bring a sense of a lightness to our experience of the area of the body where one is experiencing that light. Then allowing it to become softer, allowing it to become a kind of a benign presence. Also using the cultivation of the of loving kindness. So that taking that light and imbuing it with those wishes of well-being. Allowing light to suffuse the body, but it's suffusing it in the sense of softening and brightening, and not controlling, not containing it too much, because that sense of trying to pull it down to one's feet, trying to ignore it, to push it away, that you want to be working with it in ways that is softening and brightening, but it's also, there's a kindliness there, and it's that is really important, to allow that light to be both kind and bright, and that should shift it. It should change it, because there's an energetic that when we try too hard, You get a headache and it ends up sort of sucking energy out. But it can be a source of well-being, and it can be energizing. Following this morning's talk on non-self, do you have any advice for reflecting on remorse, regret, in the context of non-self? Remorse or regret are usually not big in my life except in one area, that of missed obligations to others. Investigation in this area rarely fortifies or informs me. It usually triggers either a well-tuned system of aversion or distraction, or else despair. I do have confidence in the Buddha's teachings, and so an inkling that this can all be dismantled somehow. It's quite a small inkle, but it did try to get my attention this morning, so any reflections or directions are deeply appreciated. Well, I think the aspect of remorse and regret is, sort of, big picture non-self. Remorse and regret needs to be dealt with in a practical way, so that one starts to identify the areas where. Where is one experiencing a sense of remorse or regret? And if it's around, in this case, there's many examples, but in this there is an example here of, say, missed obligations, where one feels one could or should have done something, and the way that remorse and regret work from the, from the Buddha's perspective, is that it's actually a, a wholesome reminder or a wholesome pointer to areas of conduct where one needs some improvement, so that it's seen as a in acknowledging to oneself, okay, that wasn't done so skillfully, and then making that determination to rectify or to do something that is. That is skillful, that is in, so that in this case of something like, okay, there is some sort of misobligation, and is making that determination, oh, that would be a really beautiful thing to do, that would be something skillful to be taking on and be attentive to, making that determination. And then setting that wholesome intention for the future. Future comes, and one may or may not act on it appropriately. But it's sort of like you're learning from past mistakes, setting wholesome intentions for the future, and you keep learning as you go. So that remorse is a wholesome reminder of conduct that that one isn't quite satisfied with. When it gets into guilt and kind of obsessing on perceptions of our unwholesomeness and all that. That is not what it's about. It's sort of a remorse is okay, there's, because it's, you know, we should be able to feel remorse about things where we really, really missed our shot, really didn't live up to our own standards. We should feel something. But it's a wholesome way of reminding oneself to establish or to re-energize and recommit to something, to a path of practice, training, living that is really beneficial for ourselves and beneficial for others. So and in the big picture, yeah, it's all non-self. But that doesn't mean one doesn't feel anything. So that, you know, it's important to realize that when we say non-self, it doesn't mean that that's a negating of responsibility or a not having any kind of emotion or feeling or compunction as a human being. Sometimes when I sit, I get this really strange feeling that parts of my body, arm for example, are moving, but I know in reality I have not moved. It's usually when I'm in deep concentration. Do you know what is happening? There are all sorts of strange things that can happen in concentration and as the mind becomes settled, and perceptions and imagery that comes up in the mind, feelings coursing through. That's why it's so important to that anchor in mindfulness and clear comprehension, because there's just that remind, okay, the feeling is my body moved, my arm moved, it hasn't. So there's that clear comprehension that it's there. And one can... But yeah, you can experience and all sorts of things you can experience. That's just sort of sticking with the program of paying attention, in-breath, out-breath, meditation object. They arise, they pass away. I remember one of the strangest things I experienced one time was just where I'm paying attention to the breath and breathing in, breathing out. And then feeling the weight of the body sort of here, but then the actual breathing was happening, about 3-4 feet, it felt up there. So I was, okay, this is not adding up. Okay, breathe in, breathe out. But you just have to, if you get caught in it, it pulls you out of the meditation. You just have to, okay, that's perception, that's a feeling, sensation, and just staying with that, the quality of knowing. Please tell us what the chant is referring to when it mentions the threefold bliss. It's the bliss on the human realm, bliss on the heavenly realm, and the bliss of Nibbana. They're all good. Is ego the same as self? If different, in what ways? I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough psychology to really. I mean, because ego is kind of it's kind of a technical Western psychological term, and I don't know enough to make a real comparison. Even the sense of self. I think there's, I'm not really qualified enough to, because even when we're just the defining self, what does that mean? That sense of, and so when the, from the Buddha's perspective, the self is the, just those perceptions of, the eye-making, the mind-making, the underlying tendencies to conceit. Trying to remember the Pali for that. But that's what's going on is that the eye, in the sense that this sense of I, that I position, is being created, it's being made. It's not a solid entity that exists independent of anything. It's being made, it's being created. The sense of mine is make that eye making, the mind making, that sense of the feeling of mine, possession and identification. Is being made, it's being created, it's being built out of our experience and our misapprehension of reality, misapprehension of truth. And the underlying tendencies to conceit. And conceit from the Buddhist perspective is the taking a position of comparison to others. So that we set up a position that we have in relationship to others as either inferior, equal, or superior in some way, shape, or form. And they are, so that those are all sources of suffering. I'm making, mind making, the underlying tendencies to conceit are all creating suffering, and they're all kind of self positions that we create and identify with, attach to. And I don't know. Again, I don't know enough psychology to know. The extent and definition of ego, but that sense of self is fairly nuanced in the Buddha's perspective. Okay, I enjoy teaching about devas. They seem to be a good counterbalance for left-brain people. Is it correct to say that Hindu deities are included into Buddhist universe as higher devas, mighty but not omniscient and impermanent beings? I'm particularly interested in Shiva, who for me is a positive symbol of cessation, relinquishment, and play of the elements. I know that Brahma is mentioned a lot in the canon, but what about Shiva? Also, since Thailand borrowed a lot from Indian culture, are there any devotional practices for Hindu deities? And if yes, are they somehow integrated with Buddhism, perhaps on a folk level? In the canon, Brahma gods are. I don't think it's. I don't say historically. I'm not sure where the. You know, in terms of the lineup of the Vedas, Upanishads, Pali canon, the lifetime of the Buddha, how specific the different deities are, or how different. But certainly, there seems that like when it speaks of Brahma gods, it tends to not be sort of one ultimate Brahma god, but a whole bunch of different Brahma gods. And then Shiva doesn't get a mention at all in the Pali canon. but then again, I don't know the timeline in terms of historical development of the Indian religion and philosophy at the time. In Thailand, there are certain Hindu deities that are kind of, you know, on a certain level, I mean, Thais are kind of very down to earth, mostly, you know, certainly originally a very agrarian society, and they're happy to integrate anything that's going to give them some advantage. So that there's, but it's not that extensive in terms of, a lot of it is more local and in terms of deities and beings that are in particular shrines, areas. And then it's fairly recent. There's been a real kind of all over the, I think, all around the country, particularly central and southern Thailand of what the heck is the name? Pikanet. Ganesh, yes. Ganesh has a real following.
Poor Nick does sculptures of Ganesh.
Really? Okay. There you go. That's
patron saint of architecture, supposedly.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, he's a builder and a sculptor. But it's a patron saint of architecture. I thought it was just to get more money. I thought that was the angle they were pursuing. but yeah, so there's a lot, especially in, say, in Thai culture, there's a very interesting mix of the Hindu and Buddhist, especially on royal ceremonies, literature. But it's historically, it's always been kind of folded in, there's a certain element, but it's not it's definitely not as discernible as when you see in India and shrines and deities and the pujas that go on. It's not quite as overt as that. I was practicing yogic pranayama for about a year to alleviate a medical problem. However, as my practice develops, I notice effects on the mind, particularly during breath retentions. Yogic literature states that there is complete and spontaneous cessation of breath in full samadhi. Is it true that some scriptural Buddhist sources say that there is a cessation of breath in the fourth jhana too? Yeah, that's a standard definition of one of the characteristics of the fourth jhana. There's cessation of breath, and it's not just in scriptural sources, contemporary. Meditation teachers talk about it. It's fairly common. That was a conflict that we had when Ajahn Chah was ill, and with the doctors, because one of the things that he would do when he was, and of course he wasn't speaking at the time, he'd lost his faculty of speech, but when his if he had an infection or if he is getting difficulty in breathing, then one of the things that he would do would be to go into a very peaceful, take the mind inward, and then he'd become more and more peaceful, more and more peaceful. Then his breathing would stop, and then of course the doctors see this. And his breathing stopped. We've got to do something. And the monks sort of say, "No, his breathing stopped. Just let him be. He's fine. How can he be fine? He's not breathing." So it was that was something. I remember after Ajahn Chah died, it was really like, I think it was the day that he passed away. Talking with the doctor who was he was actually tasked by the queen, the office of the queen, to take responsibility for Ajahn Chah's well-being, so he had a team of doctors and nurses that would be looking after Ajahn Chah's health, and then he was sort of like the buck stopped with him, and he was fairly young when he first was given that duty, and then the day that Ajahn Chah died. He and I, and I'd known him for some years, and he was also a board member on a non-profit that I had in Thailand, so I knew him fairly well, and we were talking, and he was saying, just sort of reflecting back and saying, "You know, I learned so much, not just as a human being, but as a doctor." Looking after Ajahn Chah, I just saw things that's not in the medical books. It's just not there. So I said, it was really quite interesting. So that sense of Okay, yeah, that's a possibility. Cessation of breath is a fairly, when the mind, it's like Ajahn Chah said, it's what happens is you don't really need that amount of breath. The heart is so peaceful and still that it's a disturbance to have that in and out breath. And he says, you're breathing, the way he puts it, you're breathing through your pores. Overall, why do you think there's no application of conscious control of breath in Buddhist practice? For example, no scriptural references to prolonged exhalations to help calm down the mind. Is it conceivable to speculate that Gautama Buddha did practice pranayamas with his two teachers before joining the ascetics, but somehow did not find them useful? Hard to say. I mean, the Buddha experimented with all sorts of things, and there is actual the Buddha giving an account of him trying to force the breath to stop to close all the and he said all it did was give him a headache and made him feel awful. But I think one of the things is, I mean, there is a conscious control of breath in the sense of calming the breath, but it isn't. It's using that kind of settling and calming and using the breath to soothe. Because the underlying perspective that is liberating is not in the control of anything, but in the knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. And that's a different perspective. It's a different take on things. So that when we're honing in and trying to tune into that knowledge and vision of the way things truly are, then control really is an obstacle and an illusion. So then they being able to step back and see things in their true nature, see things as they truly are. And that's where your insight into release, that's where that comes from. It doesn't come from that control. That's my idea anyway. Okay. Have a bit of a break.